Got the clip?
Hello, everyone. This is Kevin Annett. It's Wednesday, February 26, 2020. Today, as part of the preamble and deliberations of the West Coast Common Law Court of Justice that's going to convene in Vancouver, Canada on March 30th of this year, I am today charging 12 individuals with being part of a criminal conspiracy, an ongoing criminal conspiracy to aid and abet genocide in Canada. Now, before I get to naming those 12 and the specifications of what we're charging them with, I want to comment about the situation right now. People know a lot, even the corporate media is reporting the protests against the Chinese-owned pipeline going across British Columbia, liquid natural gas, the latest expression of genocide in Canada, the traditional triangle, or what I call the octopus between big money, big government, and big churches, all working together, as they have for many years, to wipe out Indigenous peoples for money. Well, that octopus that we described came from somewhere, and I've had personal taste of that for the past 25 years. This action today that I'll be describing is done on behalf of everyone. All Canadians have been defrauded into paying taxes to a genocidal government, putting money in the collection plate and footing the tax bill for genocidal churches that killed more than 60,000 children in their residential schools. You don't have to be part of this fraud anymore. You can be part of this action, stepping back, renouncing these criminal institutions and powers. And that's exactly what we're going to do today. They say evil has an address and a name, and it doesn't want you knocking on the door. Today, we'll be knocking on the door. Here are the 12 names. I am today publicly charging these individuals with being part of a criminal conspiracy. Former Prime Minister Jean Chrétien, Staff Sergeant Peter Montague of E Division of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police in BC, John Creighton, former CEO and President of Weyerhaeuser Corporation, John Kishore, United Church Minister and former Aboriginal Affairs Minister in the BC government, Marion Best, former moderator of the United Church, and Virginia Coleman, former General Secretary of that same church, John Jessamine, legal counsel for the United Church, Brian Thorpe, former Secretary of the BC Conference of the United Church, two United Church clergymen on Vancouver Island, Phil Spencer and Foster Freed, and two private citizens in Surrey, British Columbia, James McNamee and Anne McNamee. Well, here's the specifications. All 12 of these individuals were part of a criminal conspiracy that began on January 23, 1995, when I was summarily and unlawfully removed as minister, United Church minister, St. Andrew's Church in Port Alberni, British Columbia, after I had unearthed two major crimes, the death and torture of children in the local Alberni Indian Residential School, and the theft of native land by Weyerhaeuser Corporation, aided and abetted by the United Church and the BC government. Let it be known as uncontested fact that I claim that this criminal conspiracy is ongoing. It was committed with malice aforethought and without justification to destroy my livelihood, my job, my reputation, professional standing, religious vocation, and good name, also to rob me of my children and to alienate them from me permanently, and to generally attack and impede all of my work and the work on the lives of the native people I've been working with. Let it be further known that as a result of this criminal conspiracy, I have indeed suffered all of these losses and damages, and consequently, I've endured enormous personal suffering. A suffering and damages for which all 12 are publicly responsible, legally liable, and I so name them now and consider them to be liable and responsible for these losses and damages. Well, let it be further known that the purpose of this criminal conspiracy by the accused was and continues to be to aid and abet the crime of genocide in Canada by church, state, and business, and to conceal our own malfeasance and that of others in these and other acts. One, the theft of Indigenous lands and resources. Two, the rape, torture, trafficking, and murder of Aboriginal children. Three, the silencing and killing of witnesses to these crimes. Four, the obstruction of justice. Five, the destruction of the buried remains of Indian residential school children and evidence pertaining to their suffering and death. And finally, the marginalizing and destroying of the lives and livelihoods of not only myself, but anyone involved in our movement, and especially seven Indigenous activists in our movement who were killed after confronting the Anglican, Catholic, and United Churches for their crimes of genocide. And, as well as those seven, three Port Alberni residents who were also killed for the same reason. While this criminal conspiracy is especially nefarious and a matter of great public concern and interest because it involves the act of defrauding of the Canadian people, and it constitutes a threat to the laws, peace, and welfare of Canada and to the interests Canadians have in public safety and justice. And in that sense, this notice of liability and action on my part is done on behalf of all Canadians. Now, the 12 are hereby notified that they can be released from this condition of liability and responsibility. I will release them from any such liability, provided they do four things. First of all, they must publicly and in writing acknowledge their involvement in this criminal conspiracy and share all of the details of it, including correspondence, plans, so on. But they have to talk specifically about their knowledge and involvement in these four aspects, my firing without cause and my unlawful defrocking by the United Church. Secondly, the involvement of the church in my own divorce, the divorce action brought against me by my ex-wife Anne McNamee, their funding of that divorce, and their ensuring that my children, Claire and Eleanor, would be robbed from me legally, or rather I should say illegally. Finally, thirdly, the involvement of the United Church in the scuttling of my doctoral studies program at the University of British Columbia, and my attempted ordination into the Unitarian Church, and finally, the involvement of the 12 in the ongoing misinformation and black ops campaign conducted against me by the RCMP, under the direction of Inspector Peter Montague, United Church officials, and by the Canadian government since January of 1995. That's the first condition. They have to publicly disclose. Secondly, they have to issue to me an unconditional public apology and admission of guilt for these actions and take responsibility for the damages. That apology will not be a justification of their action, but rather a full acceptance of their legal and moral responsibility for the damages. Thirdly, the accused, and especially the officers of the United Church, have to restore to me everything taken from me, including my full benefits and status as a United Church clergyman. They must also publicly acknowledge the fraudulent and unlawful nature of my so-called defrocking hearing and the participation of United Church officials in the destruction of my ministry, marriage, public reputation, professional retraining and employment, as well as my university studies. And the fourth condition is that the accused must restore financially everything taken from me. They have to issue reparations totally no less than $1 million for general lost income and benefits and no less than $2.5 million for general pain and suffering. These are standard legal requirements. Now, if the accused accept this conditional offer of honorable settlement, they are not released from their liability and responsibility toward the damage they've done to Indigenous children, to Indigenous nations, and to the Canadian people. Now, the accused have until March 7th, 2020 to respond. That is 10 days from now. If they do not respond, their action or lack of action will be interpreted as constituting an act of bad faith, an admission of guilt, liability, and responsibility for the crimes of which I am publicly accusing them now. They will be admitting their responsibility for the criminal conspiracy I'm describing. Now, in the event of such a failure by the accused to respond, I will be free to pursue and obtain just and necessary legal, moral, and political remedies and reparations from all 12 of the accused, including by commencing private prosecutions and other legal actions against them, by placing liens on their properties and assets, and by performing citizen arrests on them and others, especially to defend the lives of children. Now, be further advised that any failure by the accused to respond to this notice and offer will compel me to convene a global press conference and public hearing in Vancouver on Monday, March the 9th, 2020, at which I will present the full details of their crimes, including the identity of the seven individuals who they were responsible for killing in Vancouver and the three individuals in Port Alberni whose deaths they are responsible for. I will make the same presentation before our domestic and international courts of law in the coming period and at the opening session of the West Coast Common Law Court of Justice to be held in Vancouver, Canada, on Monday, March 30th of this year. Now, the complete list of charges and specifications against the 12 accused will be presented by me and will be found online in murderbydecree.com under ITCCS updates as of March the 9th, 2020. Today, this statement is going out to all 12 of the accused. It's signed, witnessed, and issued by me today, Kevin Daniel Annett, and witnessed by Brenda Gail Hurst, a resident of the Downtown East Side. This can be found and will be posted at murderbydecree.com under ITCCS updates. I make a public call and appeal now to the 12 individuals to make honorable and just settlement with me and with all the people they have wronged. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. Stand by for more. I thank you.
And welcome to Here We Stand. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. You heard a recording that went out this week in the form of a liability notice, which has already been explained, and it went to those 12 individuals. Now, today, as follow-up to that, we want to give more explanation as to some of the things that were described there, and I'm very honored to have with me as my guest Candace Brown Bear Woman. She has been a fellow activist on Canada's West Coast. You will hear more about her story, but it has great relevance because it has to do with confronting the genocide today. She's worked in the Indigenous communities for many years, especially exposing the vaccination and death of elders and others within those communities. And Candace is going to come on in a minute, but one of the things that people have asked is, well, in that list of 12 people, Kev, how come Jean Chrétien was right at the front? This is very important because he was named as former prime minister as somebody who actually helped initiate this takedown movement against everything we were doing. It commenced during the first tribunal that was ever convened on Indian residential schools that I helped pull together in June of 1998. Just before that, and this is described actually in a memorandum that went out to all the governments of the world in September 2017, and it described something called the Chrétien Cabinet Directive of April 3rd, 1998. In effect, the government of Canada, with Jean Chrétien's instigation, decided to begin a standard black ops campaign against anyone in any group that was challenging the official narrative about the Indian residential schools. That is, there were some unfortunate incidents and we're going to compensate and now things are better. No, those of us who were showing that it was an ongoing campaign of genocide planned at the very top powers in Canada, church, state, and corporation going back over a century. Those of us who were exposing the hard evidence of that were targeted by a standard black ops campaign started by the Chrétien cabinet in April 1998, not accidentally, just before our tribunal commenced. So that is his particular piece of that, but it's a lot more complex. It involves his counterparts in the BC government, this fellow Peter Montague, who heads the kind of black ops campaign in the RCMP in British Columbia, taking down anyone who's outside the controlled Native organizations. The people, for example, at Gustafson Lake who were campaigning to stop the destruction of sacred sites there. Montague started smearing divide and conquer campaigns against all of those groups, not only against me and our what became the ITCCS, the Tribunal to Investigate Crimes of Church and State. So that's a little bit of the background as to what's happening. We're going to have a lot more of that evidence. As you heard in the announcement, if there isn't a response, we're going to be having a public release of all of the evidence in that's naming these 12 individuals for how they, by targeting me at the start of this whole campaign, they attempted to shut down the truth of the ongoing genocide in Canada. And so on that, and we'll, like I say, in future shows, we're going to have more of that. But keep in mind there's three chief actors in these crimes of genocide being described here. There's Weyerhaeuser Corporation, the United Church of Canada, and the BC and federal governments and the RCMP. We'll have more of that, more updates. And without further ado, let me bring on Candace. Hello, Candace.
Hello, Kevin. How are you?
I'm doing really well. I mean, it's good to kind of name your truth, as they say. And for many years, I've been naming other people's truth. But I thought it was time to kind of, you know, talk about how a lot of this stuff started. And you yourself have had a long involvement in this. I know I'm going to let you kind of introduce who you are in that. But I have a lot of fond memories of how we first met, our involvement when we were picketing these, genocidal churches in Vancouver. So let's get into all of that. But first of all, you know, say who you are and how it all relates to what you're doing.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I just want to say, McGwich, you know, thank you for having me on, and thank you for all that you do and all the listeners too, right? It's very exciting. I'm really honored to be here speaking with you. So a little bit about me. So I too am from Winnipeg, came out here about 30 years ago. Probably one of the best places for me to have moved to. You know, I really truly found myself and found my culture. So I'm what we call a bicultural Métis. So I've got roots in the Cree and Anishinaabe Nation, but also Irish and Scottish. And those roots led me out here to find more about who I am, and through that, meeting my people and starting to learn about my culture. But also, very sadly, I want to mention that about 26 years ago, I met a woman. I worked in a health food store, and she was from the Gitxsan Nation. And she began to tell me about residential school, and I had never heard of it before. And I would have been probably about 26 at the time, and was quite shocked and quite saddened. And as our relationship moved along, I learned more. And what else can I say? So because of that and working in the health industry, I became a bit of a, I guess you'd say, a truth seeker myself. I'm uncovering things that I saw that were injustices. And then further along, I think it was about 2000, I took a job. One of my elders from Stalo Nation had encouraged me to work for Hiokmeet, which was an organization through Stalo Nation. And I was one of the first holistic nutrition counselors. So I happily took that job, was really, you know, just excited to have an opportunity to work with the people, the First Nations people. And so I took my job, you know, very serious. And I remember, early on, my manager, my boss, who was non-Aboriginal, who was a nurse and had retired, had said to me, you know, these people deserve the truth. And what she was talking about was vaccines. And she basically gave me a permission to talk to my families and you know, sort of give them information, right, about vaccines, which I did. And a month later into that job, she came to me and informed me that, you know, I wasn't to speak anymore about that issue. And I remember actually getting quite upset, actually starting to cry and say, well, you know, the people do deserve the truth. And to me, you know, well, to you, I said, I guess this job is about money. And for me, it was about getting the truth out. So, of course, when she said I couldn't talk about that issue, if you know me, I decided, no, I needed to talk about this issue, which I did. Yep. And about a year later, to make a long story short, they tried to fire me when I knew I had just had a review the week before and had done very well and know I'd done good things with the people. And so I thought, no, you know what? I can't let these people fire me. And so I came home and put together a four-page letter and sent it to all the chiefs of Stalo Nation. And it was a resignation letter basically saying that, you know, I had too much dignity and pride, wasn't going to allow these people to railroad me, you know, pretty much. And what was interesting about that position, Kevin, was they didn't know that I was Métis and that I actually had been adopted by the John family, who were Stalo. I had kept that quiet. And they also didn't know. And I must say that these managers and, you know, supervisors were all employed by Health Canada, and they were non-Aboriginal. But they didn't know my background. They didn't know that I'd been in the health industry many years, had a lot of contacts. And so within a week, I was on a radio show like this. I had my story published in the Alive magazine, and that was basically about the First Nations people in Stalo having the opportunity to say no to vaccines because they didn't know they had a choice, right? And so that was the crux of it. Anyway,
I remember.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I remember when we met, it was because of this story that had broken. I invited you onto my program, Hidden from History, in Co-op Radio in the Downtowning side. I think you called in the first time. But I remember one of the aspects of your story that really struck me, and it kind of fed right into what we were starting to do at that time, which was to document how this genocide is ongoing. You mentioned that you, and now I hope I've got this right, it's been a number of years, but I think you mentioned that people were dying on the reserve as a result of these vaccines. Was that accurate? And they were being forced on children without consent. I mean, basically coming in and shoving the needles in the kids' arms.
Yes, how they did it was they would have a nurse that was usually non-Aboriginal, she was white, and then they would get a community sort of health rep, which would be someone who was First Nation, to go into the homes as soon as babies were born and give them these shots. So what I observed was they didn't have a choice. You know, it wasn't like me where you can go to a health clinic or your doctor. So yes. So then as that year went on, I started asking different nurses, even the nurse that had been my boss, she had said she had quit because she'd seen too many side effects and too many deaths. Now, I want to mention every month I did home visits and a variety of things. So I had to chart everything I did each month, every staff did. But my elder, who also worked with me, Ida John, we actually happened to see the paper of the monthly report that the nurses had to do that was actually very different than ours. And it actually, the title on the top said Deaths and Side Effects of Vaccines. That was the nurses' monthly report, and we were shocked when we saw that. When I blew the lid off this, the doctor, I think his name was Dr. Martin, who was the head of the First Nations Health Authority or something, I can't remember what it was back then, and basically Health Canada, was just irate that people were stopping to vaccinate. So after I quit, they did a kind of a public talk, and he was there, and I got one of my adoptive brothers to ask him, in front of everybody, are vaccines mandatory? Which, of course, he did, and this doctor's face went red, and he said, no, they're not. Again, after I quit, I had other nurses come to me who said, yeah, I can't do this anymore because,
right. Of course, that was back then. Of course, they are now. I mean, but this is interesting how it started. And what also is interesting, Candace, is when under the Indian Act, if you're on reserve, you cannot refuse medical treatment. And the reserves are often used as people there are guinea pigs because they know that legally they can go in and shove the needle in the arm of the kid and, you know, they're on legal ground to do that. Doesn't make it right or lawful, but Indian Act gives them that power, right?
Well, that's interesting you brought that up because when this all came to light, I thought to myself, I mean, obviously the issue was the vaccines, but for me, having been amongst a lot of First Nations already, you know, for me it was about empowering the people.
Yep.
And I know my adoptive family from Tuwathel, they had, as you say, the nurses would come in, give the shots. And I said to them, you know what, you can say no. And so they did. They actually made a sign up in their band office. And when the nurses came in, they said it had like a no smoking thing with a line across it saying, you know, you're not allowed in here. And since then, 20
yep.
years now, many of the First Nations of Stalo have taken their health monies and are doing their own thing with their monies and starting yep. healing centers and all that kind of stuff. So it really was a good thing because it did help the people to find their voice and say no. Right?
Excellent. Well, and you're a spark for that, too. It's funny how we can come in and be the spark catalyst for other people to go on and organize this stuff, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, and that was the beginning. And as I say, that story went far and wide. And just recently, it actually, that story just came out through my daughter. She said, Mom, I was on some show and they were talking about me. So it was kind of funny.
Really?
But, yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool when our
yeah.
kids do that because I remember like when my daughter Eleanor was in grade 10, she used to lecture her social studies teacher saying, you know, the stuff you teach about residential schools is all BS. You should read my dad's website, you know. That's always fun.
Well, I'd like to just mention, you know, along the vein of residential school, which again is
yep.
what brought you and I together, is I was going to Native Education College after I quit the job at Stalo. And there was a woman there who actually helped create that school and also the NITAP program. Her name was Grace Meyerhouse. And I want to mention it because she did a lot for the people. And she had gotten cancer, and she came to my class and spoke. It was her last class she taught. And I'll never forget, Kevin, at the end, she said, you know, there's something we're not talking about as a people that we need to start talking about. And then she said, it's residential school. And so I tell today a lot of young people, mm-hmm. you know, what it was like back then 20 years ago, how it just
yep.
was so hush-hush. And again, I remember, you know, very proudly when we would go to the churches and do these protests and drum and sing and talk to people, you know, but again, what it was like then compared to now. So, I mean, I believe we've come a long way, but back then.
Oh, yeah. And I want to get into that a little bit more, but I had another thing to just mention about what you experienced at Stalo. And now that, of course, explain to people where the Stalo Reserve is.
Well, Stalo is quite a large territory. It starts from about Fort Langley, Kwantlen First Nation, all the way up, you know, toward Hope, just past Hope. So it's a large area. I think today there's about 27 reserves. population of about 5,000. But I will mention one very shocking thing. When I took that job, my boss told me, one thing get used to is lots of deaths. And I remember thinking, wow, I mean, I'd come from the health industry where, you know, they're helping people. And that was shocking. And after I left that year, there was 17 deaths.
Oh, my God. Well, this is... Sorry, Candace, but, you know, this is so familiar because reading correspondence 50 or 100 years ago about the residential schools, these Indian agents and principals are saying, well, we can expect a lot of deaths in these schools. 25 to 50% death rate is not unusual. You know, so it's a way of desensitizing people to say, well, Indians are different. When a lot of them die, it's not a real problem. You know, it's the same mentality.
You're right. It is that mentality. And that's what it was interesting because I remember one of these particular nurses, she was just very cold. And I overheard her one day saying, you know, she said, yeah, like, I like going into these homes and giving them their shots. Like, it was really like, I was like, wow.
Yeah,
so, you know, you have people that are what I think, like, sociopaths, right? They have no conscience.
Exactly.
And really, it's a job. It's a job.
Well, even more proof of that is Health Canada, who was responsible for all this stuff, they were the same body that set up the Indian hospitals. And that's a whole other area that's been censored out of the media in Canada and research. They ran the Indian hospitals and the sterilization programs where any kid who wouldn't go to church or who spoke his own language got a red tag, they got sterilized. And that's proof of genocide right there. So it's the same body pushing the vaccinations at Stolo, right?
It is, it is. And I just wanted to mention that last year I got a brand new book. It's called Medicine Unbundled. It was written by a non-Aboriginal man, but who had done 5 years of research across Canada interviewing people. It's about the Indian hospitals. And it's an amazing book. And he connected the Indian hospitals, there was 21 of them in Canada, to the residential school. And so how they were taking children out of those schools and putting them into these hospitals, and they were doing testing. They were doing surgeries on these kids, vaccines, drugs. It is unbelievable what they were doing.
And to remind folks, there's a whole section on that. Some of the references, I'm sure, will be there. Murderbydecree.com, look in there. One of the other things, Candace, that came out was that, of course, a lot of Nazi researchers after the war in Canada, and I remember some of the folks who first talked to me about the Nanaimo Indian Hospital said, oh, yeah, we saw these funny tattoos on their arms, and they described them. They were SS tattoos on their upper arm, on the inside upper arm where the SS doctors got their tattoo. And they were... I mean, just the things they describe just right out of Auschwitz, you know, same kinds of practices. So I want to now talk a little bit about our history. And I know we began to, we had the interview about what you're going through at Stolo, but let's talk a little bit about the thing you've mentioned, which is what really began to force this issue out in the residential schools is we began to put it in the face of these churches. Can you remember some incidents of your involvement in these things? Because I got a lot of these memories.
You mean like personal stories of people?
Well, also your experience of going to these churches, the reactions of the people going in, how we were treated by the media, that whole bit.
It was shocking. We were heckled at and yelled at. And I wanted to share an incident. I remember the one evening we had went to your house and we had made posters to wear with different things on them, you know, things like, do you know what went on in residential school and different things. And I remember there was a Cree brother that joined us the one evening, and we made one that said, what goes on in the Vancouver Club? Now, I look back on that, and it could have easily been me wearing that, but this brother happened to wear that one. So we did the protest the next day, and about 2 days later, he called me saying, I'm out. And I'm like, well, what do you mean? And he told me that the night before he had 5 RCMP officers come and break down the door of his apartment and beat the you-know-what out of him, and he said, I do not want to be involved. And I remember just being shocked and thought, wow.
That was actually a friend of mine. His name was Ron Barber, and he worked at Vancouver Cooperative. He helped me get my show. And very soon after that, Ron moved to Winnipeg, and he was found dead within a couple of months. And I don't believe that's an accident. I think he's on the list of many of our other brothers and sisters who died because of this work who are native. And the Vancouver Club, of course, is the documented spot of child trafficking and child murder that goes on, you know, that elite club. So unfortunately, that might have spelled his death warrant.
Yes, probably. And I know even back to when I worked for Hyothmes, and I won't go into it, you know, in today's show a lot, but I will tell you this, the fellow who was running that, we'll call it organization, when I was there, I was seeing families, children being apprehended. And I remember one family in particular who I was really close to, and I came to work one day, and they told me, oh, they'd had their kids taken. And I said, why? And it was because they had found a joint in their house. But the point I want to make is that these children I got to know very well, they were like maybe, you know, 3 and 6, and they were put into this foster home that was non-Aboriginal couple who I really just did not have a good feeling of. And a few months later, there was an event at one of the longhouses, and I saw these children. And, you know, Kevin, just with the kind of work I do, you know, I could tell by looking at these two little ones that something had happened. Like, I felt like their little spirits were broken. And so I began to dig a bit more and found out that they were known to apprehend a lot of Stalo children, put them into these white foster homes and some other sinister stuff I uncovered while I was there. Yeah. And also, another thing is, anybody that was hired like me that was actually doing good things and actually helping the people were fired. So I was not the only one. There was,
right.
And then after I quit, my elder, who is Stalo, and who had started a traditional birthing program. She did puberty ceremonies. She was doing amazing work there. After I quit, they forced her out within months.
Right.
They made it intolerable. She couldn't work there anymore. For her own people. Yeah.
Well, you know,
not
Candace,
her own people. Yeah.
This is the standard where they operate. They isolate people who can make change, get rid of them, bring in their lackeys. Then they take the issue and they spin it so that nobody's really prosecuted or harmed for it, and the shit goes on in different form, right?
Absolutely. Well, for me, when I exposed it, they sent me one defamatory letter to try to sue me, and then they sent me a second one. When they sent me the second one, I remember my son was about 11, and I said, Tom, go get the matches. And he's like, why? And I lit it on fire. He said, what are you doing? I said, well, they're trying to put fear in me, and I'm not buying into this, right?
Yep.
And he was like, okay, right? But,
right.
Yeah. What are they, those three Ds? You heard of three Ds? Divide, destroy.
Yeah, deny, distract, and discredit.
Yeah, and that's exactly what they do, and people need to realize. And I always say, you always know when you're onto the truth when they come after you, when you're
exactly
doing something good, right?
Or like they say in the Air Force, you know you're over the target when the flak starts.
Exactly, yeah. And then, you know,
go on.
Well,
go on.
I mean, maybe we could segue into today, but like, you know, back then, as I told you, my I think one of my main goals was just to help to empower the people. And that's what I've been doing since 2013. I focused working just with my people, with the Aboriginal people, particularly here, well, and across Canada, but, you know, is finding their voice. Because, you know, a lot of my people are afraid of authority, right? When I worked at Stalo, I remember I was doing these home visits right away, and one of the elders took me aside and he said, Candace, you know, when you come talk to our people, but just come and have coffee. He says it's about building relationships and trust. And I didn't understand it back then, but I clearly do now. And that's the thing with a lot of our people. They don't trust authority. And they don't. So, you know, when I look at the work you've done, you know, and being that voice, because that's what you've been, is you've been a voice for the voiceless. And what I call a lot of our people have been the invisible people. You know, and so I it's interesting because I was told one of our prophecies said that in the future, the children of the settlers would stand with our people. And it's happening. I mean, I'm seeing it all the time, right? And I say to people like yourself, like, we need your help. Do you know what I mean? And they say what you've done is just, unbelievable, the wonderful work you've done, Kevin. And I'm just so proud of you. And as they say, I know we haven't talked for many years, but I've been spending the past week looking at what you've been doing and the books you've been writing, and it's really empowering to me, you know, when you look at others and it goes, you know, it's kind of like, you can do this, I got to get back into it, right? You know. So.
Well, and that's why, you know, I mentioned this notice of liability I sent out to people. I'm saying to all these people who tried to shut down our work and my life for so long, look, we can settle this honorably. You just have to admit what you've done and restore what you've stolen. That's all you have to do. But it's really strange how in this genocidal system, they're so afraid. They're more afraid than their victims are, you know, the people who did these crimes. It's crazy.
Could I just share a story? I met the chief of Alkali Lake. I don't know if you know of Alkali Lake, but they're a community that's been clean and dry for over 30 years. And I met the chief, an amazing woman, and she shared a story with us. They were one of the second communities to take, it was, I believe, a principal of the residential school who had gotten three girls pregnant and sent them away to have these babies. So anyways, they tried to take him to court, and they waited like 6 years, and they just were getting nowhere. So she and other elders of the community said, you know what, we're going to do it our way, the old way. So they brought this principal and his family and other, the victims and whoever, to the reserve. And she said it was amazing. She said what we were able to accomplish in 3 days. She said by the end of it, she said this principal's family was shaming him. Like it was amazing, right?
Right.
So I just wanted to share that story because I just remembered it.
Well, it shows the power. And I say, you know, I remember when we were standing outside the churches, we would appeal to the hearts and minds of the church people and say,
yes,
look, you should not be giving money to these institutions that murder children. Withhold the money and they'll change their actions tomorrow. And the power that's in the hand of the people in the pews. And I don't know if you were there that Sunday we occupied Holy Rosary Catholic Cathedral. I think you missed that
one. Yeah, I heard about it. Yes.
But it was phenomenal because we went in there and it was like there was such protection around us. The priest backed off. We had our banner. All the children need a proper burial. And when we finally go out, the cops don't even show up, which was really weird because every day they used to surround the place when they heard we were coming. But the doors were open, no cops. We walk in, tell our message, and then as we walk out, the whole congregation stands up in silent respect, right?
Wow.
And it felt like counting coup, right? We had counted coup on the Vatican right there. And sure enough, the next week the government starts talking apology, and that was no accident, no coincidence, right?
Wow. That was 2008, right?
That was 2007, and then a guy, Gary Morasty, who was a member of Parliament, Cree member from Saskatchewan, he had seen my documentary, Unrepentant, and he stands up in Parliament and says, when are we going to have the children brought home for proper burial? They announced the TRC after that, you know. Yeah, that was 2008, early spring 2008.
That right. Holy smokes.
So right place at the right time, you've got a lot of power, right?
Well, definitely, definitely. And again, when you've got the truth, right? I mean, you know that old saying, the truth shall set you free. And that's what I say to people today because, you know, and if we could talk about what's happening now, right?
Like,
I look at the work you're doing and what's happening with the Aboriginal people across Canada, across Turtle Island. I just want to back up, Kevin. So I'm not sure if I told the listeners that before I got embroiled with the issue with Stalo and the Stalo people, I had been a health activist on the international level till about, 2013. 2013 is when I went to Ottawa to lobby the Minister of Health to do with the Natural Health Products Directive, and basically that was to try to protect our natural medicines. And while I was there, again, another story, I say to people, I believe like they knew I was coming because the MP that I met with, he was a Conservative MP, actually threatened me. He told me that I, you know, had to be a registered lobbyist in order to come to Ottawa. And he said, you know, if you, you know, you can't do that. And three times, Kevin, he said to me, if you try to do that again, he says, you will get a $50,000 fine or I think it was two years in jail. He said it three times. And so I stood up and said, well, I guess this meeting is over, and I proceeded to go into the question period after that. But when I got home, I called the Commissioner of Lobbying. She went on my website, and she said, Candace, you know, anybody can lobby Ottawa. What he said was wrong. And unfortunately, I left it too long. It was about a year and a half later, I tried to go through the Canadian Human Rights Commission to make a grievance about
that.
But they said you only have 12 months to do it. But the point was, again, it was like, wow, intimidation and threatening, you know,
right,
Canadians. I mean, really? Like, wow, yeah.
Well, it's a good segue into the whole thing now because, you know, if Canada's suddenly in the news again all over the place because of all the attempt to stop the pipeline in British Columbia and then the solidarity actions all over the different nations for, you know, the road blockades, the railway stoppages and all that. Now, but here's the thing, and I wanted your thoughts about this. We saw the same thing happen, I remember 2 years ago down in Standing Rock, South Dakota, with the Lakota people trying to stop the oil pipeline, and then the Clayoquot protest back in 93, of course. Both times the same thing happened. They had these protests, but then these Aboriginal puppet leaders came in, negotiated the deal. The pipeline went through, but they got benefits, right? And everybody went home. And I just smell the same thing in the works here. I don't know what your thoughts are about that.
Yeah, it's, what can I say? Okay, well, I think I because of my connection, so after I left Ottawa in 2013, I decided to stop being an activist and working in that kind of world, let's just say. And I decided to spend the time to get to know who my people were and who the leaders were, who the spiritual people were, and just get a sense of what's going on. And that was at the same time that Adel Namor started. And so I got involved right away and started to post things on their Facebook page. That's kind of what I've been doing since and supporting that work. And so Adel Namor, I have witnessed to be, has been a really good thing for our people because for the first time ever, we've been able to communicate and talk. And so social media in general, I think, has been like a godsend for our people, right? And so through that, I've met a lot of very, very good people. And so, but I've also got to learn a lot, you know, learn about, in Alberta, I had a job with a Cree woman. We were teaching Aboriginal culture and awareness to a variety of people from companies like SynCrew to people of the city of Fort McMurray. And through that, like, I learned more about the past, and then I got to learn more about the Indian Act, because I really did not know the power of that Indian Act. I didn't know about the pass and permit system, which I'm sure your audience knows about, and I always tell even my people, because, see, a lot of my own people don't know their own history, right? And
right.
So I'll add to that, so when they forced the people onto the reserves, they implemented the pass and permit system so they couldn't leave, they couldn't have economies, and all these other things, but they hired these Indian agents. And so through the Indian agents, they created this new, you know, electoral system of appointing a chief. Now, I can only speak for my people because I'm Cree, but I have learned quite a bit about our Cree laws, and each nation, we had 9 clan mothers, and we chose headsmen. Or we had hereditary too, okay?
That's right. Yeah.
And again, they were following a completely different system of our own laws and laws that were spiritual and all this. And so, yeah, so back to what I saw happen was, so they had these Indian agents, they created these, you know, chief, you know, electing these chiefs. And then what happened was, and this has been going on for a long time now, is it was usually one family that would get in.
Exactly.
And he'd be the chief, and he and his family would control all the money, and everybody else in the community would be left to live in poverty, and I've seen it, witnessed it, and you've heard it, right? So now, here we're at a place in the last, let's say, 5 years, or it's probably more than that, where you have to realize, like, a lot of our people, like, I would say since Adel Namor and Standing Rock was an amazing thing for our people, it was a great gathering place. But since Adel Namor, it's brought our people together to get educated and talk about the history and talk about these things and educating our youth. Because I say to people, today we have more of my people in politics than ever before. We have so many of our people that are educated, you know, lawyers. I'm not sure if your listeners know, we have opened in Victoria the first Indigenous law school in the world. So even people like myself, I was going to go to law school a few years back, and was stopped in my tracks when an elder gave me a book called Nationhood Interrupted, and I started to learn about my people's Cree laws. And so here we are today, where you have, in a lot of communities, they're actually getting rid of these elected chiefs and putting in hereditary chiefs. So this issue we're facing today, yeah, you have that divide, and
right.
We know clearly the connection to these big companies with these elected chiefs. Right?
You know,
they have shoes
definitely.
And company, right?
Well, you know, the thing about BC too is that there were very few treaties ever signed there, and
right.
And it left a lot of leeway for people to start doing other stuff. And so one of the things I did want to bring it to that, we've got less than 10 minutes left for this show, but definitely want you to come back. The pipeline in issue is actually owned by PetroChina. It's the biggest oil and gas company in Canada. And one of the chief directors of this company is a guy called Zhou Yong Kang. He's a former head of security for China. And guess what he runs? He runs the prisons where they do organ trafficking. Now, we know that from the early RCMP reports, they were finding Aboriginal women their bodies missing organs. But that got swabbed out of the police reports around the same time that you're working at Stolo, early in the century. And we know there's a bigger agenda going on there. And a lot of this Liberal government so-called missing women inquiry, I didn't know if you know this, but the mandate in that missing women inquiry said they were not allowed to interview RCMP officers because Human Rights Watch in New York had already named the RCMP as having been involved in the murder of Native women. And yet it was whitewashed right out. And so all the time that these good things you're describing is going along parallel with this continual institutionalized cover-up. So we can't really know the real story unless you're on the ground.
Exactly. Well, and I did a year stint in Fort McMurray. I actually honestly really didn't want to move there because, you know, I knew how polluted it was. But I went there, and it was an incredible year. My husband and I spent a lot of time with the First Nations, with the Métis, and lots of different people. And we learned a lot. And I know one of the big reserves out there that sits right in the middle of the oil sands has a chief that's been in, again, 20 years and got to learn a lot about this person. And I was taken onto the reserve, and I saw brand new homes, and nobody lives in them. The chief doesn't even live there. He's got a house in, you know, Phoenix, Arizona and stuff. And she was telling me that there's elders that live in shacks. This is in Fort McMurray. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
When I was there, we had seven First Nations people die on the streets that winter. So I learned a lot in how, just in 20 years, how they relocated because of the tar sands, a lot of the Métis and First Nations, right? And one last thing I want to say about that area is we met a lot of local people, you know, where they can't fish, they can't hunt, they can't trap, nothing. And when you talk about the missing and murdered women, my boss's sister-in-law was one of those. They found her body. But, yes, there was a lot of girls that would disappear because of those man camps. And I went up to those camps. I worked in them. I did talks. So I got to see, and I'll tell you, oh, that's a story that itself, these man camps. People wouldn't believe it. They couldn't believe it. Yeah, unless you go there and you see it and you hear the stories from the people, right?
Well, you know, one of the projects we're trying to do in the coming year is do a sequel to our documentary film, Unrepentant. We want to show how the genocide's carrying on, this new kind of neocolonial systems they set up. So that kind of input is exactly what we need in this film, Candace, and I hope we can talk about more of that in the future, about how we can document things going on today, like what you did at Stolo, like what I've been doing since 92 and all that stuff. And that'd be a great topic for a whole show.
It would be. And just to let the listeners know that I think I said earlier, I decided, you know, since 2013 to just work with my people. So today I work on the ground, grassroots with the people. I'm a family counselor and I teach parenting classes. So I'm getting to see other sides, like in CFD that I never, you know, I heard the stories, but I'm living it. I'm working with families that, like, when we talk about genocide, it's still going on, and it is unbelievable. In the hospital, I could tell you so many stories. Yeah, it's amazing. But I'm really honored that we reconnected, and I'm able to have a venue to be able to speak, because there's a lot that I know that needs to get out there, and I'm not afraid to speak about the truth, right?
Well, Candace, maybe, this is an open mic. Maybe. It's your mic as well. Anybody else who has this kind of information, like we've said, we've been running this show for 5 years now. After I got thrown out of co-op radio, which is a whole story in itself, but I definitely want you to come back. And thank you, Candace, Brown Bear Woman. It's an honor to have you on, sister. We'll have you back. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Take care.
Yep. Bye for now. And that was Candace, Brown Bear Woman. And one thing, I got a question coming here by email while we were talking, and they said in this statement of liability you sent out, Kevin, were you speaking for yourself or on behalf of the natives? And I said, no, it's on behalf of me. But here's a note that was in the press release we sent out. This notice was issued in conjunction with CM Capilano, who's the traditional elder of the Squamish Indigenous Nation. And CM Capilano legally evicted the Catholic, Anglican, and United Churches from his territory, which encompasses all of Greater Vancouver, in a writ filed in the Supreme Court of British Columbia on March 4, 2008. On the same day, Capilano appointed me, Kevin Annett, to act as his legal agent to enforce this eviction order and to prosecute these churches and the Government of Canada for crimes against humanity. Now, that's very important to know in that I am acting in conjunction with this Indigenous elder and others including the Anishinaabeg Nation Winnipeg, who adopted me and gave me the name Eagle Strong Force. So it's a parallel operation. We're walking side by side with each other. And I'm legally and morally authorized by Kiapilano to do all this work, to evict the churches, to hold them accountable for genocide and everything else you're hearing today. So I want to thank you all for tuning in. I'm really happy to have Candace back in our life and in this work. And we'll have her back again. If you want to have involvement in what you're hearing, follow murderbydecree.com under ITCCS updates. That's the regular news that's posted. We will be having more news next week about the upcoming events to bring on more of this evidence about the 12 co-conspirators in genocide that I have named. And as I mentioned, it's all leading up to the opening of the West Coast Common Law Court of Justice in Vancouver, Monday, March 30th. If you have evidence about ongoing crimes of genocide, child trafficking, murder, etc., please come to that event. Write to ITCCS office at protonmail.com for more information. And we're going to end on one of my favorite songs, Goodbye to the Crown. That's what we're all about, folks. The Republic of Canada, in unison with the Indigenous nations, bringing back the true republic and reclaiming the world and our nations for ourselves and our children. And until next week, folks, thank you. Stay strong. Stay clear.